Welcome to the Aftershock Central podcast with Travis and Martini.
Martini!
Yes, that's right.
The mystery is revealed.
The mystery is revealed. We're here to talk some Aftershock. Ronnie is unavailable. I don't know where he's at.
Yeah, if you've heard from Ronnie, let us know. We just, you know.
I mean, he sent the message at like 4, so he's around somewhere. Who knows?
Yeah. I mean, maybe he's in class again, dude.
Oh, he might be. That's very true. No, that was yesterday, right?
Oh, yeah, you're right.
Yeah, that was yesterday. Anyways, let's talk about some Aftershock books. There's a ton of books to talk about. The schedule has failed me once again, Travis. Because last week I was like, we only have one book to discuss next week. We'll talk about Out of the Blue. And then we get the review copies, and there's 4 books.
Yes. It was a surprise.
It was a big surprise. I said, I guess I should get reading.
4 book week is heavy, like, just by itself.
It is. You're right.
Yeah.
Because I think last week we had 5, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, we did 2 weeks worth, but
that's
4
right.
or 5.
Yeah, that's right.
I think it was...
Yeah, I think we had 4 new ones, and then we talked about 1 from the previous week. Cool. So we're going to kick things off talking about Dark Red, number 2, written by Tim Seeley, with art by Corin Howell, colors by Mark Englert, and letters by Marshall Dillon. Didn't Mark work at Malibu, right? I'm pretty sure he worked at Malibu.
Hmm.
I'm going to have to look this up while we discuss this book. But for some reason, I was reading something recently, and I saw Mark's name on it, and I was like, wait a second. Anyways, Dark Red number 2. Let's talk about this. I'm actually a little sad that Ronnie's not here, because I know Ronnie loves political commentary in his comic books. And I really like the way that this book is doing the political commentary, in particular the reveal that you get kind of towards the end about the vampire Nazis.
Yeah, dude. I mean, that's politically loaded, right?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. I mean, like, I don't know. It's not the first comic to, you know, have like Nazis in America, or, you know, the first story to conflate, you know, vampires with Nazis.
Yeah.
But I certainly think it's deliberate as far as trying to make that thematic front and center in, you know, this story, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And what I think is interesting is, like, you know, who is the face of it? You know, like the one that we meet first, really, or, you know, like the boss guy,
Victor,
who's making the pitch. Like, yeah, like, I mean, he's like bougie, you know, suit wearing rich guy, right?
Yeah.
You know, like, so, you know, that's like the unlikely face of, you know, that's not what we think of when we think of like the Nazis in America, you know?
Yeah, that's why it was a cool twist.
Yes.
Although, I mean, I should have seen it coming. I was kind of upset with myself when that was revealed, because we learned pretty early on in the issue that he's part of the Nosferatu like mafia or something. I can't remember what it was that they called it. It was something Nosferatu something. And,
See, I thought that he was getting chased out by the Eventide, or the Eventide.
Yeah, the Eventide is the group that's going against the Nosferatu.
Okay, so they're against, like, Nazi guys.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. But because Nosferatu is a German film from the 20s, I should have made the Nazi connection as soon as they said Nosferatu, and I didn't. So I was a little upset with myself, because you know me, Travis. I like to find those kind of things, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that I don't know, like the Nazi whatever, you know, like that contingent, like in America, is really strictly like devoted to the German heritage per se, you know, like. I don't know how much they really gravitate towards that, or if it's like an American version, but I don't know. Fraught stuff. I don't want to dig into it really.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. I mean, and I assume that Eventide is a German connection as well. I mean, I took 5 years of German, and I was trying to figure out, like, what Abentide meant. I don't recognize Tide. I mean, I remember Aben, but I don't remember Tide. So I don't know. It seems like one of those, like, angels versus demon things, right? So the Nosferatu obviously look very demon-like. And Aben in German means, like, the just. So I assume maybe it's, you know, like, I guess more typically what you see in a vampire film, right? Like, very pale, like, Aryan-looking people. That's kind of weird now that I think about it, because when you think Aryan, you would think Nazi also. Anyways, so I was trying to figure out what it meant, and I don't know. I'm sure Tim has done a bit of research when he's coming up with this stuff on what to name these different vampire clans. Or it could be, I mean, it could be a different language, because I can't remember the lady vampire that we met at the end of the last issue that was also in this one, but she's not German, right? I assume by the name Russian, but she does mention something about Polish vampires. So maybe she's Polish?
Yeah, I mean, the boss dude, like, calls her, you know, a Polish slur.
Yeah.
In the issue. So I think that's a safe bet.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe. I like the little, the sexual innuendo with the swordfish. I thought that was pretty funny at the beginning.
Yeah, he doesn't play it cool.
Well, I mean, the girl's sitting there naked or standing there naked, and she's obviously very well endowed, so that was interesting. Camille Magdalena Kersmerick. Man.
Yeah, they call her Cam in the issue for short,
sure.
I think.
Yeah.
So that's certainly easier.
Yeah. It's funny how when I was reading her dialogue, I was reading it just like in normal English. And then as soon as I saw the name, I started doing like a Russian accent. Like when she's like, "You already saved me, Mr. Chip." I was like, "Oh yeah, I could see her saying that."
Yeah. Well, you gotta recalibrate now, dude, for
sure,
Polish.
Absolutely.
Go watch Sophie's Choice.
Oh God. the question that I don't know if it was you or Ronnie that had this question after the first issue about who's drawing the crayon pictures all over the house. It's not kids, it's Chip.
Yes, and it seemed like they kind of I don't know it, where that led thematically was like that he misses the daylight, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, since he can't see it firsthand, like, his solution is to, you know, draw a crayon picture of it.
Yep.
Or, I don't know. Could you be so bored that, like, whatever, you want to draw, you know, like, if he's artistic, like, maybe crayons is his medium. But, I mean, it's, like, you know, not a typical choice.
Yes, I agree. And I don't know how long he's been a vampire. We kind of debated this on issue one. But, I mean, you would think, even if he's only been a vampire for, like, 10, 20 years, and he's been drawing pictures of the sun for that amount of time, you would think his pictures would look better than, a six-year-old.
Yeah, definitely.
But maybe it's just me. I also like the two redneck dudes. I think we saw them in issue one as well. They kind of serve as a nice comedic relief. In between things, it almost reminds me of, you know how, I don't know how much Shakespeare you've read, but Shakespeare always has these, like, side characters that don't really partake in the main story, but they definitely, number one, provide humor, but also give you a lot of exposition. And that's kind of what these two guys reminded me of. So I thought that was cool.
Yeah, for sure. That's a good call.
Mm-hmm. I am a learned individual.
Yes, this is basically Shakespeare, so.
Yeah. Yes, it is.
Yeah.
It's Game of Thrones with vampires.
Oh, I don't know about Game of Thrones.
I don't know. I don't watch that terrible show.
I like Game of Thrones. That's a bit of a diversion, but. Okay, let me ask you, I'm kind of curious about, in reading this, why they need Chip, the main dude.
Yeah.
You know, like, because they come in, they make a pitch to him, and it seems to like involve him heavily.
Yes,
you know, but he was on his way out of town.
Yes.
So whatever claim that he had on the town, like, that's irrelevant because he was going to be gone anyway. They could just do it, set up shop, do what they want.
Mm-hmm.
My read on that, I guess, is that because they're coming in, they're like, you know, Yankees, you know, and you know, like, the, I don't know, at least the ones that we've seen are pretty, like, bougie.
Yes.
You know, elite looking. So, like, maybe they need a local face to put on it or something?
Yeah, well, I think part of it is that, right? Because, I mean, he's like, you can run the town, basically, you'll be the town hero, this, that, and the other. But part of that still doesn't make sense to me, right? Because he mentions the whole thing about laying claim to the town, and, like, he mentioned how big the area was and how they respect vampire territories and this, that, and the other. But, like, Chip is one guy, and this Nosferatu clan obviously has a ton of vampires, right? I mean, you would assume at least a few dozen, right? And they obviously seem very well off, very wealthy, just based on what you see out of Victor. So I would assume they have a lot of resources, right? Manpower. Maybe, like, you've seen Blade, right? You know how in Blade they have the familiars, like humans that help the vampire cause.
Yes.
So I would assume that they have all of this, right? There's a ton of vampires. They have a bunch of humans working for them. You're telling me they can't take on this one guy? Like, who cares about respecting the claim, right? They obviously don't really care about that kind of stuff because they really just want to take over.
Yeah, and I mean, kind of more even on that is, you know, the end of last issue, they, like, send people to kill him, right?
Yeah.
And, I mean, like, my read on that, because I was like, at least in the beginning of the issue, you get the indication that whoever sent them, the people that were meant to kill him, is different from the ones who sent, like, Naked Lady Vampire.
Uh-huh.
Right? And, like, it occurred to me that if that is the case, and that's not just a ruse of some kind, that maybe they, like, the thralls or whatever, were sent by the Eventide, because later on they mention, like, the Eventide seems to favor, like, holy water icicles.
Yeah.
So, like, if there is a factional thing, maybe that's, like, who sent them, and maybe, like, they're just trying to remove him as a threat or something, because it's clear, I don't know, like, I don't know, they realize what's happening, you know? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I still thought it was a ruse because I think Victor mentioned something about sending, like, rednecks or something to kill him. I just figured that that's kind of so that Chip doesn't actually think that they were behind it, right? And that's maybe why they sent this one girl with the holy water icicle, right? That's part of the throwing them off kind of thing. I don't know. It seemed really weird. And the way that Victor explained things seemed different than the way Cam explained things to him, last issue. So, I mean, it's pretty obvious that Victor is not a trustworthy character anyway. He just tries to find the best way to sell his story.
Sure.
Right. And it seems really good, right? I don't know how you felt, but I think Chip kind of believed it for a little while. Until he mentions, I guess Renee had the Star of David necklace. And that's when Chip's like, oh, you're a Nazi because she's Jewish.
Yes. I mean, I think that, you know, it could be a case of, you know, him hearing what he wanted to hear, you know, like Chip, like, he wasn't just listening. He was also offering, like, his own, like what he wanted to do. And Victor's like, oh, yeah, that, for sure. That's what I was talking about.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
And you could also maybe just, like, include kind of, you know, the euphemisms of, you know, like, Nazi types or whatever, you know, like you can talk about things a certain way, but they don't really necessarily, like, they're saying something. There's a lot between the lines, I guess.
Yeah, sure.
You know?
Hmm.
Maybe.
Still too early to tell.
Yeah.
But there's definitely a lot of social commentary. And sometimes it's pretty obvious, right? Like when Victor's giving his whole speech about what they want to do with the town, he's in front of like the National Enquirer. You know, it says like, "Look her, or lock her up." There's like the Make America Great hats behind them and all that stuff. So there's obviously some indication that you're supposed to think that this is kind of that group of people, right? And not necessarily selling a real dream.
Yeah. And I mean, also, you know, I thought it was cool that they included early on, like, this idea that, you know, you plant these, like a bag full of opioid pills and, you know, like, that to me just, like, puts the opioid epidemic, like, into the mix thematically about, like, looking at middle America and stuff.
Yeah.
You know, like, so I thought that was pretty cool. I don't know if there's any more to it or if it's just kind of a passing reference, but.
Sure.
Yeah. You know, that's pretty topical.
Yep. Yep. I agree. And obviously there's, the issue is about to hit the fan because at the end we get a bunch of, Nosferatu vampires with swastikas on their foreheads heading into town.
Yes.
And
I
like that whole thing too, by the way, because the cop pulls the truck driver over because she's got a tip that there's a truck full of illegals riding around.
Mm-hmm.
And when she opens up, it's just full of vampires. Full of Nazi vampires.
Yeah. I mean, I was gonna make a joke, but I'm not gonna go there.
Sure, fair enough. All right, you want to rate it up?
Sure. I will go 4.5 out of 5, and also I'm doubling down on my guess that dude was like fought in World War II against the Nazis.
Yes. I will agree with you.
Cool.
I will also give this a 4.5 out of 5. Last issue was great. This issue was awesome. And I love that last page too. I like how Victor is like a different kind of vampire, right? We haven't seen Chip in like full vampire form, but you know, we see these Nosferatu vampires in the truck and they look more like typical vampires. Victor's got that like split jaw thing. Like they have in Blade, was that Blade 2?
Yes, I think so.
Yeah, I dug that.
I thought they just broke his jaw in half or something.
I mean, could be.
I thought he just got messed up.
Could be.
We shall see. Right.
We'll see. All right, next book is The Lollipop Kids, the final issue, question mark. Final for this series. Obviously, there's going to be some more, especially once you get to the end of the issue. Spoiler pause! It sets up for the next series. So written by Adam Glass. Yes.
Are you going to pay royalties to VCR for the spoiler pause or?
Listen, VCR is outdated equipment. They don't make them anymore. Okay. They are very pricey on eBay though. I mean, a VCR costs like $300. I don't know if you've looked this up.
I have not. No.
Mm-hmm. They're very expensive. Matter of fact, I'm going to look one up right now and see how much they cost. So I give you an exact real-time price. Oh, they're much cheaper. For a while, they were like $300, dude. You can get them on eBay for these are all used. If you go on like – I think Amazon still sells brand new VCRs. So let me go in there because I know I've seen them. I looked them up one time as a joke. Yeah, $75, dude. Who wants to pay $75 for a VCR?
That's not that bad.
Nah, it's not that bad. No, I'm not paying royalties to anybody. Ha! Written by Adam Glass, art by Diego Yapur, story by Adam and Aiden Glass, colors by DC Alonso, and letters by Sal Cipriano. So this is the final issue. We got a lot going on. We got a nice resolution. As a person from New York, I enjoyed some of the stuff that's brought about, like some of the landmarks that are mentioned here, like the Whispering Bench, you know, the Statue of Roosevelt and all that stuff. I thought that was cool. Although, I had an issue with the Whispering Bench. We'll get there when we get there. Yeah, I thought it was a pretty solid issue. I think out of all the books that Adam has done for Aftershock, and I'm going to say this with the thing you should remember is that I really love this book. So I'm going to say something, but know that this book is going to be rated very highly. I think out of all the books that Adam has written for Aftershock, this was the most straightforward. And I'm trying to use like the best possible language because I wanted to say simplest. But I think if I say simplest, that's got like a negative connotation, and I don't really mean it that way. But I do wonder if like the fact that some of the story ideas came from his son, that that's why some of the things that happen in this book feel a little extra MacGuffin-y. You know what I mean?
Sure.
Like, you know, the whole time we're maybe kind of looking for Excalibur to defeat Morgan Le Fay and the witches. But like real quick in this issue, we learn that, you know, they're looking for the sword, right? They spend like half the issue looking for the sword. And then within a page, we learn that Morgan set it up so they would go find the sword so she can get the sword so that she could be free. But then she gets killed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, let me go beyond that. Like, you know, she needs the sword to escape.
Right.
Why? You know, what is it about the sword? What does it do? You know, like, what did, you know, Nick and Mia think it would do? You know, like, it definitely, like, to not have any of that about, like, why is this thing having this central role? Yeah, it's like, it doesn't really matter. It's definitely a total MacGuffin.
Yes. But at the same time, like, that's okay, right? Because this is kind of a very, like, magical, mythical world. So a lot of times when you have a lot of magical stuff, the story does end up being full of MacGuffins.
I mean, I think it would have just taken one more line to be like, and this is why I needed Excalibur, you know? Like, not even, like, it could have been very comic booky, but something, you know? But, like, it just doesn't matter at all.
Mm. Yes. I don't know.
Unfair, maybe.
Oh, hang on. Yeah, no, I agree. But at the same time, like, I don't think it really detracts from the story, right? Because ultimately, the story isn't really about the Lollipop Kids. It's about a brother and sister kind of learning who they are and learning to appreciate each other.
Yeah, I mean, but that kind of actually brings up that, you know, I think there's a second MacGuffin, which is the gift that, you know, Nick has for Mia, right? So that's the whole reason why he went out to Central Park or whatever, I believe.
Yeah.
He has this gift he needed to give her, and she wasn't around. And he gives it to her, and she doesn't open it, mm-hmm. you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it was, like, supposed to be, like, the best gift ever or something, you know? Like, so, I was a little disappointed that they didn't deliver on that. And like, you know, beyond that, you know, they're like strangers now, you know?
Well, not really. Cause when he gives her the present is like right at whatever it is, whatever time it is when she turns 18. Right. So all of a sudden she's got like all this time that she's not going to remember. Right. And one of the times will be this time when he gave her the present, because this happened during like a Lollipop Kid event, right? Like if they had been at home having dinner, then she probably would remember and open the present. But because they just got through this long battle or whatever, I think that's one of those things that will be erased from her memory. But you're right. It is kind of sad though, right? Because after this battle, they got to a point where they understood each other. You know, she said she told Nick that she loved him. And, you know, she's not going to be estranged from him anymore and all this stuff. And all of a sudden, like, none of that really matters because everything they just went through is erased. So really, like, they got to kind of start from scratch. Although, I don't know if, to be honest, Nick would even want to start from scratch, right? Because I think Nick got out of this what he wanted, right? He wanted his sister to acknowledge him and realize that he cared for her and she cared for him. And he's happy with that. And the fact that she won't remember any of this may be relevant to Nick.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Like, does it count if it happened and it only was that way for, like, a few minutes? And you know, and then she doesn't remember it, you know, like it's tragic for sure. But yeah, like I don't know if that would be satisfying if that's what you went into it for, you know?
Yeah, I don't know, man. I think it's one of those things where like, you know, the fact that Nick actually tried to get this done is might be good enough for Nick.
Yeah, they saved the day, so like that's good enough.
Yeah, I mean, I guess. I mean, I see yeah. your I see your point, but I think overall, I don't know if it matters as much, right? Like, I felt like this was a pretty good ending to it. Like, sure, like she doesn't remember. Maybe they got to start over. Maybe they don't. Who cares? But like Nick has figured out who he is, and I think that's been a big theme of this whole series. So ultimately, that's accomplished, and obviously Nick apparently is very good at being a lollipop kid because the other kids want him to be the leader of the kids. Now that his sister's gone,
mm-hmm.
Big Red still my favorite lollipop kid.
I like Serial Killer.
Yeah, he's pretty good.
Just for the name.
Yeah, yeah, he's pretty good. So what'd you think about bringing in more lollipop kids into this thing? And by that I mean like historical lollipop kids, right? Because when they're looking for the sword, we learn about a couple. We learn about the bum that's under the bridge. They got him to kind of play these musical notes that they had found. It turns out that like all the homeless people in Central Park used to be lollipop kids. And the reason they're there is because they kind of leave everything behind when they start having dreams of being lollipop kids. Which that seemed kind of weird. Did that seem a little weird to you? I mean, I like it as a way of explaining things around this park, right? Cause I mean, I'm very familiar with the park. I used to cross the park all the time. So it's cool getting some of these things that are in the park explained through the mythology of lollipop kids. But like, there's a lot of homeless people in Central Park, number one. And I mean, I don't know how many lollipop kids there are, but we only see what, like 5 or 6. So I just kind of assumed there was on like a small group, right, at a time. Yeah, give me some thoughts.
Yeah, I am going to agree that I found that confusing. Maybe not for exactly the same reason. Like, the thing that I found confusing about it was, like, okay, so, like, let's just say that this guy that we saw, the homeless guy, was, like, you know, a good example of like, the people that fall into that. And let's just say even that that's, like, not even a super common, like, result of the lollipop kid experience.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's passed down from parent to child, and mm-hmm. those people become homeless people that are then in the park, how are they passing on the lollipop kid thing? You know, like, I don't know. Did this dude have kids, you know, before, you know, he ended up a homeless dude in the park?
I mean, I think you have to kind of assume that he did, right? If you want to follow this thing that they have to pass it through the family line.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it's possible that you would be doing, you would adult and, you know, have kids and then be so driven crazy by your repressed memories that you end up homeless in the park.
Sure. And I mean, you don't know how long that guy's been there, right? Like he could have just shown up, right? Like he might have grandkids by now. But to your point, like, again, we don't know how many different families there are of lollipop kids. But if that's the case, and you know, we've only seen this like 5 or 6 families, then wouldn't he be like one of the other kids? He'd be like Serial Killer's grandfather. You know what I mean? It's possible.
Yeah.
At the same time though, you know, like suspension of disbelief, right? And the thing is, this very much feels like, I know you're a little bit younger than I am, but this feels like a lot of the 80s fantasy movies that came out, like Neverending Story, that like those kind of things, right? Where like everything is a MacGuffin, but that's kind of how the story flows. That's what makes the story what it is. And ultimately you just have to learn to accept certain things in order for the story to be enjoyable. And I think, you know, obviously we try to dive deep into some of these books, but maybe sometimes like we don't need to dive as deep. Because really, maybe some of the things that are said should just be taken at face value. And once we do start going deep, like we're doing right now, maybe some of those elements break apart. And like I said before, yeah. I still really love the book. So regardless of that, when I was reading it, I really enjoyed what I was reading.
Yeah, I mean, I've liked it on the whole. You know, I don't know, I felt like it, I don't know, maybe it wrapped up a little. I don't know that for me it stuck the landing quite as much, just because like for me there was a lot of intrigue about where is it going, and it didn't go there. So maybe like, you know, additional volumes will kind of get to that mm-hmm. more. I take your point that yeah, you can read, you know, for different things, you know.
Yeah.
And maybe world building wasn't the priority here. And I think to your earlier point, like one of the things I think that probably was a big priority in telling the story, and what I think was one of the you know, more successful aspects of it, was including these Central Park locations and things, you know, which like I'm not familiar with. I've got to look it up, but like there's a lot of stuff in there that is specific to that area. And I think that's a big part of what the story is about, you know, that it's this magical and dangerous place with a lot of rich history and mm-hmm. mysteries, you know? Mm-hmm. So I'll give them points for that, you know?
So, one thing that I was sad about is that Roosevelt never mentioned he was a lollipop kid.
In Rough Riders?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess he wouldn't because he's an adult, so he forgot.
Yeah, I mean, like, let's shared universe it. What's it going to take? Can we do, like, is a Twitter thread enough to to join the canon? I mean, like, maybe in the next Rough Riders, we can take one of these old school, like, lollipop kids and streamline them in to the next team or whatever.
There you go. There you go. So the one thing that I didn't like was, as I mentioned earlier, the Whispering Bench. Because in this book, the Whispering Bench looks like just a typical bench. And the Whispering Bench is not a wooden bench. It's a giant 20-foot, like, half-circle bench made out of stone. I think it's granite. And that's why, like, the whispering thing works, because the sound travels in this curve, so you can hear it on the other side. I mean, with the bench that we see in the book, it kind of looks like a witchy, magical bench, you know? So I get why that was the design, but I think it would have been cooler to have, like, this giant rock bench shown there.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like a lot of it is very accurate, so that's surprising to hear.
Mm-hmm. But outside of that, no other issues.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I'm going to say I was a little confused how they set up this, like, breadcrumb trail, when it all kind of seems to be, like, pointing to somebody that's later and later. You know, like, the architect pointed to, like, actor who pointed to Teddy Roosevelt. I'm not sure how that all worked in terms of setting it up, but mm-hmm. you know, again, like, probably don't gotta get caught up in the details.
Yeah. Yep. What'd you think about the epilogue? And then we'll rate it up.
Oh, yeah. Interesting that you're setting up that one of the lollipop kids is maybe a traitor. So you're like, I don't know which one.
Yep.
Clearly, yeah, that's the hook.
Is it one of the ones we've met, or is it another one also?
Yeah, I mean, like, I don't know. Like, can you assume that it's something that is recent and current? I guess you must if they're setting that up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Also, yeah, I was interested by the gremlins, because they kind of reference that they're traitors to their own kind.
Yes. But did you get the feeling that maybe they're also traitors to the lollipop kids?
Yes. Yeah, I think they're, like, playing both sides.
Yeah, yeah. Because, I mean, I assume they're also considered monsters, right? So they're also stuck in the park? Just they've been smart enough to figure out, like, hey, maybe we can help the Lollipop Kids and find a way out of here. And it seems like maybe they did find a way out. Now, the thing is, will they actually tell the Lollipop Kids about these whatever runes or whatever that are around these pipes where now they can get out? Like, how's that going to play out in the next series? I mean, I think we can assume there's going to be a next one, right? I think Adam's done pretty good job at Aftershock, and they kind of let him continue his work. So, I mean, I would love to see at least one more series of Lollipop Kids.
Sure.
Because now we got the whole setup, you know what I mean? Like, now we can get rolling into some heavy stuff. I mean, I don't know, maybe not. It's kind of a YA book, but still.
Yeah, no, I'm with you that you laid the groundwork and now you can explore the characters. And, you know, like, you're not starting from square one. So, yeah, I'm definitely down for more.
Cool. All right, let's rate it up. I'm going to give it a 4 out of 5.
Cool. I will go 3.75 out of 5.
Shameful. Just shameful. All right, I'll let you pick the next book. You want to do A Walk Through Hell or The Replacer?
Let's do Walk Through Hell.
All right, A Walk Through Hell, number 9. Written by Garth Ennis, with art by Goran Suzuka, colors by Ives Forsina, and letters by Rob Steen. All right, so this centers mostly on, what's her name? The head of the FBI.
I think it's Driscoll.
Driscoll, there you go. Centers mostly on her. There's some interesting stuff that happens at the beginning. The whole issue is really interesting, right? Because Driscoll went into the warehouse to look for the other agents. And so this is kind of what she's found in her journey at the warehouse. But there's some stuff that's brought up that kind of has me confused, but at the same time has me realize that maybe the story is not as weird as it has appeared to be for 8 issues. And the reason I say that is because it seems like everything she finds that we've been seeing as this, like, creepy stuff going on at the warehouse, she's finding it all. And they all seem to be, like, movie props.
Yes. I mean, that's what we see in the beginning of the issue, right? Is, like, the arms sewed together, stuffed with straw and, like, corn syrup, blood.
Mm-hmm. And then Hartzinger is just, like, a wireframe.
Yes.
Holding a gun.
Yeah.
Like a literal wireframe.
Yes. But then at the end of the issue, she wakes up in the blood, right? And it's, like, where she was, and her gun melts.
Yes. Or does it?
I don't know.
The reason I say that is, does what happen at the end of the issue happen chronologically in terms of the issue? Or is what happens at the end of this issue, like, when she wakes up at the warehouse after she goes in? And then the issue actually begins after she starts finding all this stuff is fake?
I don't know. I don't know if there's any indication about that, but also, you know, like, seems like she, you know, all the scary stuff is happening right now at the end of the issue. So if it is the result of chemicals or something, you know, like, that's got to wear off before she wakes up and realizes that it's all fake.
I mean, to me, there's two interpretations, right? And the reason I say that is the issue begins exactly how that last page starts, right? She's laying in the blood.
Mm-hmm.
So there's two ways that this could be happening. Either the way that I just said it, where the stuff that happens at the end is actually happening before this issue begins. Or the second theory is she goes in the warehouse and we see everything chronologically. Once she gets out of the warehouse, she starts getting all this information about Paul and all this other stuff, learning about this, like, secret cabal within the FBI and the government that has been helping Paul and has set this whole thing up. And then once she keeps poking and poking, they're like, all right, we can't have her poke anymore. She's going to figure things out. Let's just throw her back into the warehouse. Or I would say more like into the experiment. Because this whole thing reminds me of, like, I don't know if you ever heard of, see, I wish Ronnie was here because he knows all about this. Have you heard of MK Ultra?
Mm-hmm.
All right. So this reminds me of, like, MK Ultra, right? Where they're, like, experimenting with, like, psychedelic drugs and like sensory deprivation and like all this kind of weird stuff for like torture or like Manchurian candidate people, you know what I mean? Like that kind of thing, mind control and stuff like that. It almost has that feel, right? Because like, why else would we see these things that we've seen as real before as props in the issue, right? It's almost like they're experimenting on these FBI agents, possibly using some kind of hallucinogenic drugs or something, but making it seem real through the use of props.
Yeah. I mean, could be. That's interesting. I don't know. If that's the case, it would, I guess, imply a pretty, some kind of substantial time jump over the course of the issue. I would think, right? You know, like, at least the amount of time it takes to get a hold of this guy and meet with him and have him dig stuff up and, I don't know, like, days at least, right?
I mean, maybe. I just feel like the whole series, you kind of don't really know what the time frame is. So why would that change with this issue? You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. do we really know how much time has passed in the last 9 issues? Not really. I mean, we can probably assume from the time that issue 1 starts until Driscoll goes into the warehouse last issue, it can't be but like a couple of hours.
Yeah. I mean, let me ask you this, though, because like in past issues, Driscoll's been in the warehouse, right? Like, so like, is the premise that she was in the warehouse and it was, you know, dark and she was tripping out and like, you know, like getting these ghost messages on her phone and then she snaps out of it and like she's present and talking to people and they're like realizes this is like what you're describing, you know, like an elaborate hoax. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like then she's snapped back to it later. Like my read was that it was like some kind of dream or something that this stuff is happening to her. But for some reason, she was getting visions of like this fake scenario where it gets debunked and then dropped back into where she was before. I don't know. It's pretty unclear.
Yeah. I'm not sure. Yeah, I think the time frame is a little difficult to figure out. I'm trying to go through the book right now, and yeah, I mean, it seems like her talking to was he her boss previously? Like he's just a contractor now, I think. But I'm pretty sure he was either her boss or like somebody higher up than she was at the FBI.
So I think the guy that she's talking to worked for the FBI formerly, but like, I don't know, something happened and now he is, you know, independent.
Yeah.
And, you know, like the boss that you're thinking of, maybe like he's mentioned in all of this, because I think the idea is that her boss and, if I read correctly, like illicit lover, you know, like, you know, like turns out he's got some dirt on him. He's connected to this cover up that is central to all of this.
Right.
So yeah, like that's kind of the meat of it, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess so. I'm still unsure about like all the stuff that she's finding though.
Yeah. I don't really know where that specific thread is going, you know, like, this is a very significant part of this issue. And like, they're talking about this file and, you know, it's like that it's unusual enough to strike her attention and maybe somebody left it to be discovered, you know, but like, who would do that? You know, like it was somebody directly involved. So I'm wondering if, whatever his name is, Joe Rogers, if he left that himself. You know, so that like, and like knew maybe that someday somebody would come his way and be like, what's up with this?
Yeah, possible. I just flipped through the whole issue and I think part of both of my timelines were right. you know, when you mentioned that she had been in the warehouse before, she's only been in the warehouse the one time. So she goes in the warehouse, she wakes up, finds all the fake stuff. We get flashbacks with the contractor. She gets out of the warehouse, calls the rest of the FBI in, and they're going through all the props. She goes back home and starts thinking about the stuff she was discussing in the flashback and all the stuff that's going on with Paul and the agents. But there's nobody else at the warehouse. It's just her finding the fake props, which, like, number one, where are the other agents? Two, where's Paul? Three, why did the SWAT team go crazy if there's nothing really going on at the warehouse, right? Or was this whole thing set up before Driscoll got there? They cleaned it up and left. And then after we get her reflecting all the stuff is when you get that final page where she wakes up and you have the melting gun thing. So maybe based on the stuff that she found at the warehouse, this secret cabal now wants to discredit her. And they're doing that by actually putting her in this experiment.
Okay. Maybe. Yeah, I mean, I like it. That's more than I've got, so.
yeah, really complicated books. Really good, though. Really good. This was definitely one of the more straightforward ones, I think. And I say that very loosely because it's not necessarily an easy read.
Yeah, I mean, I was confused when I was reading it. And overall, I kind of am generally confused about where it's going. But, yeah, I mean, I like it.
Great. Let's rate it up. You're first.
I will go 4 out of 5.
All right. I will go 4.5 out of 5. I think this might actually be the lowest rated issue of this book for me.
Really?
Yeah. I think I've given every other issue a 5. Huh. All right. Well, that leaves The Replacer without a number because it's, 64-page original graphic novel.
Mm-hmm.
So that's awesome. The Replacer, written by Zach Thompson, with art by Arjuna Susini, colors by D. Cuniff, and letters by Marshall Dillon. This was really interesting, to me at least.
Mm-hmm.
I think maybe you enjoyed it less than I did. But I really dug the setup of this, and it's kind of implied a little bit once you get into the story when Gary, I think, is a kid, right? When Gary's watching all these scary movies after his dad has a stroke. Because a lot of the way that the story unfolds really feels like a certain era of horror flicks, right? Where it's more like a suspense thing than an actual scary thing. And as a result, I like that because I think that requires a little bit smarter writing on those kind of horror flicks as opposed to something like Saw or Hostel, where you just scare people by whatever, ripping someone's guts out or sewing them ass to mouth, whatever. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So I dug that. I'm curious to hear your thoughts because I saw you chimed in our chat, but I don't want to dig in because I wanted to discuss it on the podcast. But give me some thoughts on this book.
I mean, certainly it's, you know, a novel. You know, big concepts, idea, you know, like, you know, it's heavy stuff, right? You know, you're dealing with a parent that had a stroke and like, obviously it's very debilitating and mm-hmm. they like, basically they're reduced to like a baby, you know, and internalizing that as, you know, like, oh, you know, it's like a monster, you know?
Yeah.
That's pretty original. I guess, like, I think maybe it's just not for me. Just from the perspective of, like, I probably skew towards escapism when I'm, like, reading comics. Hmm. So, you know, I can be down with like pretty, you know, depressing or heavy like subject matter, but you know, like this almost maybe was a little bit too grounded. I thought it was always pretty clear and pretty realistic, like what was happening, aside from the occasional like thing that seemed to be pretty obviously like a dream sequence, you know?
Mm. I mean, I guess I understand what you're saying, but I thought it was interesting. It was kind of like when we were discussing her final descent, right? Because really that was kind of a psychological journey through the grieving process, but wrapped in this like mythological story of going down to hell and trying to find your family. It's kind of the same way here, right? Gary kind of sees this demon thing that's possessed his dad, that's going to make him better so that he can eat him. Like, I don't know, the rationale there seems a little weird. I didn't actually look up this demon thing. What was it, like Kinji Niji or something like that? But they kind of discussed a little bit about the origins of it in the book. But it was interesting, though, because as the story progresses, you see kind of how this event impacts the rest of the family. And then you start seeing the demon kind of taking over some of the other members of the family, right? Like, at one point, he's controlling the sister. At one point, the mom. Towards the end, you kind of see Gary is being controlled by this demon. So I thought that whole thing was interesting, because I like that kind of imagery. I think it makes things more interesting, to me at least. I know Ronnie and I have talked about this in regards to other subjects, not necessarily comics. But one thing I like about, for example, mythological stories, right? Like any culture, it doesn't matter. Is how you can read it in a certain way, and it seems like this fantastical story, right? What can I use? I mean, I don't want to use the Bible because I don't want people to get mad. Whatever. You can read a particular story in one way, and if you take it with a literal meaning, you get one particular message out of it, right? Whereas if you take the language to mean something beyond what's actually written in those words, right? If you find the meaning in between the lines, then you get a completely different message. That's kind of been a thing in, for example, a lot of religions where you have like the mysteries, right? You have knowledge that's given to like the every person, and then you have the secret knowledge that's given to like the initiated and the elite. And in some ways, like, to me, this feels kind of like that, right? Like, well, yeah, ultimately it is about how does a family deal with a member kind of losing total control, right? Like, how does that impact a partner, right, the wife in this case? How does it impact the kids differently because of their age or their gender or whatever it is? How does it impact other aspects of their lives, right? I mean, I think we get the hint that the dad wasn't necessarily like an upstanding guy, right? It seems mm-hmm. like he was kind of a slacker. He didn't really work. He just hung out at home and like worked on pet projects maybe and watched horror flicks and porn apparently. So maybe like he wasn't the best father figure. But like, you know, maybe he was, right? Like obviously he cared for his kids. You don't see a whole lot about the relationship between him and his daughter. But he obviously cared about Gary. That was like kind of his partner in crime. Even though he literally used the kid to lie to his wife about going to church, whatever. But there's like a lot of things in there. So like how do the people react? And you know, how do these different people make things easier for themselves? And one way obviously is to create like this imaginary figure that's taking over the dad and like doing other things to other people to kind of for one, I mean, Gary feels like the demon is doing this on purpose to like laugh at him. So, you know, maybe Gary's got some kind of like schizophrenia or some other mental disorder. Or maybe that's just like how he grieves. Although I kind of want to go with the first one because I mean, he almost kills the dad at the end, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like he's got a knife to his throat, but then he snaps out of it. I don't know. I thought it was really interesting the way that it was done. And really at no point do you feel like the demon is like a literal figure there until that, those final couple pages in the church where the demon's kind of like, hey, yeah, you should release him from his pain. Cause then you'll be stronger and he'll be better and this, that, and the other. But outside of that, like, you don't really get any of that stuff, right? So I thought that was interesting. I mean, it reminds me of, like, what was it, The Exorcist, and that comes up in the issue, because he watches The Exorcist as research.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I guess I would ask you, like, I think I saw something from Zach, right, at the end where he, like, kind of said something to the effect of, like, I don't know, it was, like, suggesting that this is, you know, somewhat biographical or something, that, yes, like, he went through this, and, like, on some level, mm-hmm, that, like, this comes from a place that maybe he was having thoughts like this, mm-hmm, you know? Like, at least that's what I thought. So, I mean, like, I don't know, maybe I wish that they had leaned a little bit more into trying to make it seem like this was happening, whereas, like, to me, it kind of seemed like, obviously, this was all in his head or something, or, like, that maybe is, like, your comparison with her Infernal Descent, you know, it's, like, how could you but take that at face value on some level, because you're seeing this stuff happen, like, you see her take this journey. I wish it felt a little bit more fantastic in that sense, like, that it was more than just, I don't know, like, obviously it's, like, it's a metaphor, but it seemed a little bit, like, obviously a metaphor. I don't know if that makes sense or not, you know?
I mean, yeah, I know what you're saying. I don't necessarily disagree with you. But I also think that, like, I don't know if it was necessarily super obvious, you know? Like, I feel like I'm familiar enough with Zach's work where, like, it seems to me like, yeah, this is not an actual demon. But then that kind of defeats the purpose of the whole story, right? Like, part of what makes the story what it is Gary believing that his dad is possessed by this demon, right? If that wasn't the case, then it would just be a nonfiction story.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, I feel like there's a lot of significant scenes of his, like, mom and sister being like, you're crazy, this is not happening, you know, like, I don't know, I guess, like, the weight of that, I was never really thinking that it was actually happening.
Sure.
But to your point, and to its credit, I think, you know, the real life storyline certainly was, like, powerful, you know, like, especially when they started to get into talk about, like, how remarkable this recovery was, you know, mm-hmm, like, that seemed to be a constant message from the doctors and the mother, is like, that, like, this guy is busting his ass to, like, get better, you know, like, and, like, I think that was pretty effective and touching.
Mm-hmm. I agree. All right, you want to rate this up?
You first.
I'm going to give it a 4.5 out of 5.
Nice. I'm going to go 3.5 out of 5.
Mm-mm-mm. Shameful.
Like, maybe it's not quite my thing, but, like, I see good stuff in it.
All right, fair enough. I thought it was great, and I think you're wrong. And Ronnie agrees with me.
Clearly, yeah. He'd be yelling at me right now.
He would. Oh, he's going to yell at you after he listens. Don't you worry. All right, let's talk a little bit about Out of the Blue. This was a graphic novel, original graphic novel, came out a couple weeks ago, written by Garth Ennis with art by Keith Burns. We've got colors by Jason Wordy and letters by Rob Steen. So I'm going to just say this right up front. I am not a fan of this genre of book. So we're gonna switch right now, Travis.
We're switching roles?
We're switching roles. This kind of book is not my thing. When Dreaming Eagles came out, I think, matter of fact, Dreaming Eagles came out before this podcast started. I think we started this after, like, issue maybe 2 or 3 had come out. I ended up reading that whole series basically in one shot. And it kind of surprised me. And I think maybe the fact that I read the whole story in one shot really helped. But I've never had an affinity towards World War II stories. And you know, every time Garth Ennis does one of these books, I always get at least the first issue. Because I think Garth Ennis is a terrific writer. He always has, like, incredible artists on all of these books that he does. And so I always want to check him out. Okay, and I never really continue, right? Like, what's he doing now? World of Tanks. I read like the first issue or two of that, and I kind of quit reading it because it's just not my thing. I don't find World War II stuff really all that interesting. I know a lot of people do, and that's fine. That's just not my thing. And obviously, Garth Ennis loves this era because he writes books about it all the time. I mean, he's been doing it for years and years and years. And so he's obviously got a passion for it. It just kind of doesn't really fit what I kind of like out of books.
Well, certainly agree. Like, my kind of knee-jerk reaction generally is like, there's already been a lot of World War II stories, you know, like as far as wars that people have told stories about, you know, be it movies or TV or books, I don't know, like it seems like we're good on World War II, you know, like it's pretty thoroughly documented. So when somebody's like, I'm going to do a new World War II story, it's like, okay, it's like it's very well mined territory. This is like my general reaction. To its credit, this seems very super richly detailed and thoroughly researched.
Absolutely.
So like that's great. You know, it's like a time capsule slice of life. Like it definitely seems like the point is getting across the reality of like just a specific part of, you know, that war. I would just also add that, like, I can't believe this is the first like Garth Ennis World War II story, or even just like general war story that I've read. And I don't know how to square this, but this is the same guy that wrote The Boys and Crossed and Jimmy's Bastards, right? How is it the same guy?
Well, he's a very talented guy.
Yeah, driven by just like polar opposite like sensibilities. And like I got no qualms with being respectful for the, you know, subject matter and stuff, you know. Mm-hmm. But it's just I don't know how to reconcile the two, you know. It's just like you're driven by completely different motivations.
Well, I mean, he's a writer, and as a writer, you are able to do that kind of thing, right? Because you can kind of envelop yourself in this world of fantasy. And like, I'm sure some guys, like, I'm sure if somebody told Garth Ennis, look, I'm just gonna pay you $1 million a year and you just write whatever you want, I guarantee you he would just write war books for the rest of his life, right? Like he's extremely passionate about it. He loves it. Okay. Now, if I was that guy, I'd be like, look, I'll pay you $1 million for the rest of your life to write comics. But I would ask for him to write stuff like A Walk Through Hell or The Boys, like the hardcore stuff, right? Like, I think for me, what I like best about him is when he does like cerebral horror type stuff, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Stuff that's like dark and gritty, but makes me think at the same time. That's what I love about him. He's amazing at that kind of thing. But I can also respect, I mean, I don't want to sound like we're crapping on this book, because I think as a World War II book, it's actually quite good. But it's just an era that doesn't excite me. I don't know. Like, I feel like if he wrote like, a book about like the Roman Legion or something, I would be like all over that. You know what I mean? But like World War One, World War Two, like doesn't really excite me. And to your point, like I see what you're trying to say about it's well documented. But at the same time, one thing that I think Garth does very well is a lot of the stories that he writes have some kind of basis in like actual battles, right? It may not always be like real historical people that he's putting in here, but like the battles are all real. He may take like certain elements of stories that he's heard about things that people did and kind of intertwine that into what his characters do. But as a result of that, you get like some really interesting aspects that I don't think you necessarily get out of more, nonfiction type World War II stuff. Because some of it is really great. Like I mentioned, Dreaming Eagles, I really enjoy that. World War Tanks, I enjoy that. I really enjoyed this also. What did he do, Sarah? I don't know if he picked up the TKO books, but he did Sarah for TKO, and that's a World War II book based on this like sniper squad of women, Russian women. That's, you know, a real thing also. But, you know, like I said, I enjoy them. Just ultimately, they're not up my alley. And I don't think Ronnie chimed in on this on our chat, so I'm not sure what his thoughts are on Out of the Blue, and I don't want to put words into his mouth either. I don't know if Ronnie's a World War II guy either. You know what I mean? I think maybe this is just not a book for us.
I mean, like, all that being said, like, I actually, you know, thought it was pretty well done for what it was, you know?
Like, yeah, I mean, it tackles interesting things, right? Like, racism is definitely a big part of this book, and I think that's tackled very well in the way that it's done. I mean, racism was a big part of Dreaming Eagles also, and that was really nicely done as well. I mean, the characters feel like people, right? But that's just kind of how Garth Ennis writes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, he writes characters and dialogue well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like, also, you know, like, talking about digging into the specifics, like, I thought the kind of the communist subplot was pretty interesting.
Yeah.
Like, that's in there, you know, for a reason, obviously. Sure. Like, you know, and I don't know, like, whether it's just because that was a big part of what was going on in Scotland at that time, or, you know, just because if it highlights this kind of awkward truce between, you know, like the West and the Soviet Union during the war, that like they would blow up as soon as it was convenient to do so. Like, that's so that, like, there's something brewing there thematically. And, you know, like, character-wise, I thought there was some interesting stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, I think the central part of this story is, like, you're looking at this pilot guy, and he's kind of, like, Mr., you know, like, unconfident, you know, like, basically, like, no agency. He's, like kind of, you know, in the backseat for his whole life, except when he's, you know, like, fighting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, that's where he really actually lives his life. And, like, that, I don't think coincidentally, is, like, the thing that his wife is absolutely unwilling to engage with.
Yeah, yeah.
So, like, the one thing that makes him alive is the thing that she takes zero interest in.
Mm-hmm.
Like, almost to the point that I wonder if she's jealous of the war. You know, like, he'll talk about whatever, but if he's talking about the war, she's like, do we need to talk about this? Because I know. You know?
That sounds like and me and my wife when I talk about comics.
Comics, yeah, okay, yeah. Yeah, she's a comic widow. it's a big club.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so, I mean, like, I think that's interesting, you know? Like, and, like, the dude's boss, like, pulls her aside and is like, you don't even know, like, how, you know, ridiculous your husband is. And, like, he did it just, like, because he wanted to get back to you. And, like, I thought that was an interesting, like, being confronted like that, you know,
mm-hmm.
is interesting.
Sure. I had a thought as you were talking. I just want to run by you and see what you think. So Garth Ennis used to do war stories for a long time over at Avatar, and that's gone now. I think Avatar is not publishing anymore. And there's definitely a reference to an issue of War Stories, I think, in the second story, right? In Out of the Blue. I'm curious if this is kind of like a test, putting this out. I mean, obviously he did Dreaming Eagles for Aftershock, so there's that. But I wonder, because this maybe feels a little more like in that War Stories realm, if this is kind of like, hey, let's see how this book does. And if some of the people that were getting War Stories come over to Aftershock and get those, if they'll start doing more of this kind of book, right? because I think there's definitely a market for war stories. I mean, I can think of like six people just off the top of my head that I talk to on a daily basis that love war books. I'm curious what you think.
Yeah, I mean, it's possible. Like, this is probably the first actual like historical war comic that I've read. Mm. And I guess I'm curious whether there were other writers that were on the war stories thing for Avatar, or, you know, like whether this is maybe just a thing that they will continue to do with Garth because he's got to do it somewhere. So like, why not, you know, do it with Aftershock?
I guarantee you Garth has something in his contracts that says, yep, I will put out this book, but you have to let me write a war story.
Mm-hmm.
I bet he's got that everywhere. I'm telling you, the guy loves war stories.
Clearly, yeah.
All right, you want to rate this up or final thoughts?
No, I think I'm pretty good. Yeah, as I say, I liked it for what it was. I'm going to go 4 out of 5.
Oddly enough, I will also go 4 out of 5. Will it be something that I pick up often? Probably not. But I really enjoyed reading it. And I think the art is quite good. Did you buy a physical copy of this also? Or just a digital?
Just digital.
Okay. So I double dip in Aftershock. I get all the stuff physically. And I get the review copies. And I get a lot of the times on Comixology. So I guess I triple dip sometimes. But I did buy this in physical. And I think it reads a lot better than the digital copy does. The art is just a lot crisper on the printed page.
I mean, like, I don't know. I don't buy anything physical if it's available digital.
I gotcha.
So that's just my thing. But, I mean, yeah, like, more power to you.
Fair enough. All right, that wraps up our discussion. This might be the longest episode we've ever done. Holy moly. Next week, we have two books, and those books are Volition number 5 and my book of the year, Descendants number 1. I'm going to rate it right now, 5 out of 5.
Well, that is a spoiler.
Spoiler, 5 out of 5. Yeah, that's it. If you want to reach us, you can find us on Twitter, as always. Travis is at The Great Magnet. Ronnie is dead to me. No, I'm just kidding. That'd be funny, though, if his Twitter was at dead to me. At Rambo316, that's where he's at. I am at Geekvine, and the show is at Aftershock Pod. Thank you for listening. Catch you next week!